The clergy were to be free from lay jurisdiction and from taxation, and exemplary cruelties were to be practised upon the heretics, none of which things Frederick did. As we've already told, he wouldn't even relinquish Sicily. He liked Sicily as a place of residence better than he liked Germany. Innocent III died baffled in 1216, and his successor, Honorius III, effected nothing. Honorius was succeeded by Gregory IX in 1227, who evidently came to the papal throne with a nervous resolution to master this perplexing young man. He excommunicated him at once for failing to start upon his crusade, which was now 12 years overdue, and he denounced his vices, heresies, and general offences in a public letter in 1227. To this, Frederick replied in a far abler document addressed to all the princes of Europe, a document of extreme importance in history, because it's the first clear statement of the issue between the pretensions of the Pope to be absolute ruler of all Christendom and the claims of the secular rulers. This conflict had always been smouldering. It had broken out here in one form and there in another, but now Frederick put it in clear general terms upon which men could combine together. Having delivered this blow, he departed upon the Pacific Crusade of which we've already told. In 1239, Gregory IX was excommunicating him for a second time and renewing that warfare of public abuse in which the papacy had already suffered severely. The controversy was revived after Gregory IX was dead, when Innocent IV was pope, and again a devastating letter, which men were bound to remember, was written by Frederick against the Church. He denounced the pride and irreligion of the clergy, and ascribed all the corruptions of the time to their pride and wealth. He proposed to his fellow princes a general confiscation of church property for the good of the church. It was a suggestion that never afterwards left the imagination of the European princes. We'll not go on to tell of his last years or of the disaster at Parma due to his carelessness, which cast a shadow of failure over his end. The particular events of his life are far less significant than its general atmosphere. It's possible to piece together something of his court life in Sicily. He describes towards the end of his life as red, bald, and short-sighted. But his features were good and pleasing. He was luxurious in his way of living, and fond of beautiful things. He's described as licentious, but it's clear that his mind wasn't satisfied by religious scepticism, and that he was a man of very effectual curiosity and inquiry. He gathered Jewish and Muslim as well as Christian philosophers at his court, and he did much to irrigate the Italian mind with Saracenic influences. Through him, Arabic numerals and algebra were introduced to Christian students, and among other philosophers at his court was Michael Scott, who translated portions of Aristotle and the commentaries thereon of the great Arab philosopher Averroes of Cordova. In 1224, Frederick founded the University of Naples, and he enlarged and enriched the great medical school at Salerno University, the most ancient of universities. He also founded a zoological garden. He left a book on hawking, which shows him to have been an acute observer of the habits of birds, and he was one of the first Italians to write Italian verse. Italian poetry was indeed born at his court. He's been called by an able writer the first of the moderns, and the phrase expresses aptly the unprejudiced detachment of his intellectual side. His was an all-round originality. During a gold shortage, he introduced and made a success of a coinage of stamped leather, bearing his promise to pay, in gold, a sort of leather banknote issue. In spite of the torrent of abuse and calumny in which Frederick was drenched, he left a profound impression upon the popular imagination. He still remembered in South Italy almost as vividly as is Napoleon I by the peasants of France. He is the Grand Frederico, and German scholars declare that in spite of Frederick's manifest dislike for Germany, it's he and not Frederick I, Frederick Barbarossa, to whom that German legend originally attached, that legend which represents a great monarch slumbering in a deep cavern, his beard grown round a stone table against a day of awakening when the world will be restored by him from an extremity of disorder to peace. Afterwards, it seems, the story was transferred to the crusader Barbarossa, the grandfather of Frederick II. A difficult child was Frederick II for Mother Church, and he was only the precursor of many such difficult children. The princes and educated gentlemen throughout Europe read his letters and discussed them. The more enterprising university students found, marked, and digested the Arabic Aristotle he had made accessible to them in Latin. Salerno cast a baleful light upon Rome. All sorts of men must have been impressed by the futility of the excommunications and interdicts that were levelled at Frederick. 13. We've said that Innocent III never seemed to realize that his ward, Frederick II, was growing up. It's equally true that the papacy never seemed to realize that Europe was growing up. It's impossible for an intelligent modern student of history not to sympathize with the underlying idea of the papal court, with the idea of one universal rule of righteousness keeping the peace of the earth, and not to recognize the many elements of nobility that entered into the Lateran policy. Sooner or later mankind must come to one universal peace, unless our race is to be destroyed by the increasing power of its own destructive inventions, and that universal peace must needs take the form of a government, that is to say, a law-sustaining organization, in the best sense of the word, religious. A government ruling men through the educated coordination of their minds in a common conception of human history and human destiny. The papacy we must now recognize as the first clearly conscious attempt to provide such a government in the world. We can't too earnestly examine its deficiencies and inadequacies, for every lesson we can draw from them is necessarily of the greatest value to us in forming our ideas of our own international relationships. We've tried to suggest the main factors in the breakdown of the Roman Republic, and it now behooves us to attempt a diagnosis of the failure of the Roman Church to secure and organize the goodwill of mankind. The first thing that will strike the student is the intermittence of the efforts of the Church to establish the world city of God. The policy of the Church wasn't wholeheartedly and continuously set upon that end. It was only now and then that some fine personality or some group of fine personalities dominated it in that direction. The kingdom of God that Jesus of Nazareth had preached was overlaid, as we've explained, almost from the beginning by the doctrines and ceremonial traditions of an earlier age and of an intellectually inferior type. Christianity, almost from its commencement, ceased to be purely prophetic and creative. It entangled itself with archaic traditions of human sacrifice, with Mithraic blood cleansing, with priestcraft as ancient as human society, and with elaborate doctrines about the structure of the divinity. The gory forefinger of the Etruscan Pontifex Maximus emphasized the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. The mental complexity of the Alexandrian Greek entangled them.